Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
I thank all of you for coming here today evening. And we'll continue our discussion on the topic of what your phone can teach you about your mind. I spoke in the first part about the default settings and how just as a device has its default settings, which will make it function a particular way. Like that, our mind has certain default settings, which we may call as attachments or conditionings or inclinations, which make it function in a particular way. Today, in the second half, I'll focus on how to deal with the mind in terms of the practicalities. In one aspect of the practicalities, the theme will be that improving the hardware can't solve software problems. Is someone projecting this? Fine, yeah. So, does anyone remember the metaphor of how we compared the human self to a computer system? What is like what? The hardware is like?
Body.
Mind is the software. Soul is the user. Excellent. Thank you. So now, suppose I have a phone in which nothing is getting displayed. Now I may think, why is it not getting displayed? I may think, okay, you know, maybe the problem is that my display screen is damaged. I may replace the display screen. And still, I find that the problem remains. I get, oh, I think maybe this new replaced screen is also a problem. I get another screen. We may spend a lot of time and energy and money in replacing the screen. But say, if there is a software problem because of which the display is getting blanked out, nothing is coming on the screen, then that particular software problem, I will not be able to solve by simply changing the hardware. So the hardware and software are two distinct levels, two distinct aspects of a phone. Although when we talk about the phone, we normally think about the phone as a physical structure, the hardware. But hardware problems cannot be solved, software problems cannot be solved by changing the hardware. Similarly, you know, we all at times feel dissatisfied, we feel irritated, we feel depressed. We go through a variety of emotions in our life. And we are often in today's materialistic culture told that, okay, if we just achieve, if we just achieve certain external things, then we'll become satisfied, we'll become happy. So for example, somebody may be feeling dissatisfied. And then we look around in the world and we may think, oh, because you know, this person has a better car than what I have. This person has a bigger house than what I have. This person has a smarter phone than what I have. Whatever it is. You may think, oh, that is because of that I am dissatisfied. And you may think, I just have to work, I have to earn enough and I have to get that thing. Now when we get that thing, we may feel good for some time. But Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita that when we are in the mode of passion, lobha pravrittir arambha karmanam ashamaspruha rajasyetani jayante viruddhe kurunandana. In 14.12 in the Bhagavad Gita, he says, when the mode of passion becomes very strong, at that time, a characteristic of that mode is lobha. Lobha means greed. So, the greed is manifested as a craving for something, dissatisfaction because of not having something. Now, I want this car, I want this house, I want this phone. However, the greed is like a corruption of the software inside us. And even if we get that particular object, we will not become satisfied. Because getting that object is not solving the problem of greed internally. So there's nothing intrinsically wrong in getting better material things. Now, if we need them, if we can use them, that's fine. But thinking that getting those things will make me happy, getting those things will remove my dissatisfaction, that is a path that is a dead end. Actually, it's not a dead end, it's like a mirage. We just keep going on and on and on and on. So, right now I feel dissatisfied because I don't have that big a house. And I get the house and then I feel satisfied. And then I find somebody else has a bigger house. The mind will find, the mind that is in passion does not need a reason to be dissatisfied. It needs to be dissatisfied. That means it does not need a reason to be dissatisfied. You feel, oh, because of this it's dissatisfied. But dissatisfaction is the default setting of the rajasic mind, of the mind that is more in the mode of passion. Its default setting is dissatisfaction. And what it finds is not a reason for dissatisfaction, it finds an excuse for dissatisfaction. Now, suppose as parents, we want our child to do something. And the child, please do this, child says, no, I have homework. No, you can do the homework later. No, I have so much homework. Now, after some time, we can find out whether the child is giving a reason or the child is giving an excuse. Reason is actually authentic. Yes, it's a certain, in a certain situation, indicates because of certain circumstances, there is inability to do something. So, when there is inability, we can say it is a reason. When there is unwillingness, what comes out is an excuse. I don't want to do it, but I don't want to tell openly that I don't want to do it. So I come up with some creative reason, which is actually an excuse. So the mind is often like a mind. Sorry, the mind is often like a child. And as a child, it often comes up with excuses. This is, I'm dissatisfied because, you know, because I don't have this, because I don't have that, because I don't have that. And we keep craving and slaving to get those things. But if the default setting of the mind is that it is greedy, the software of the mind is corrupted by greed, then no matter how much we achieve, we will not be satisfied. And no. This is a, go ahead. Okay, sorry, there is it. Where? Computer screen. Okay. Is it on? This way? Okay. Anyway, whoever is operating, they can operate also, no problem. Okay. Now, please go back. Please go to the previous slide. The previous slide. Okay. So this, I talked about the default setting getting corrupted, the software of the mind getting corrupted with a wrong default setting, that is greed. And so no matter how much we achieve, we will not be satisfied. This applies at a much general level also. What is that more general level? That in our today, in today's society, we see a phenomenal amount of material progress, at least as compared to recent history. The kind of technological wizardry, the level of comforts that we have today are far more than what people could have even imagined a few decades ago, what to speak of a few centuries ago. Today, just by pressing a few buttons, we can talk with anyone in any part of the world. So we have a huge level of comforts and facilities as compared to the past. At the same time, we find that people are still stressed. People are still distressed. The level of mental health problems has phenomenally shot up. So we are comfortable physically, but we are distressed internally. We are miserable internally. So today, We could say people are comfortably miserable. At a physical level, we may be sitting working in an air-conditioned office, but physically we are comfortable. And we may look back at, in the past, people used to work as farmers in fields in the hot sun, sweating so much. You know, we are living in a much more progressive society. Yes, in the past, people were sweating because of heat. Now, today we live, work in AC chambers, but we sweat because of fear, because of stress. So, the comfort at a physical level does not necessarily mean happiness. We are comfortable at the physical level, but because the mind is stressed, the mind is distressed, we are comfortably miserable. Physical progress has not brought mental peace. This is an elaborate topic. I will go into some detail in it. But the important point to recognize is that anxiety is a huge problem in the world today. In fact, sociologists talk about modern society being infected by what they call as the anxiety epidemic. The anxiety epidemic. Millions and millions of people are suffering from anxiety. And it's curious that normally we associate anxiety with some external uncertainty. Say, if we are going to catch a flight and then we are running late into the traffic jam. We don't know for sure whether we'll reach in time or not. Then that uncertainty causes anxiety. So if anxiety is caused by external uncertainty, if the external uncertainty goes down, then the anxiety should also go down. Now if we compare, say, first world countries like America with third world country like India. India is developing now, but still to some extent it is a third world country. So the external level of certainty is much more in America than in India. In India, in many places, if you turn on a tap, there is no guarantee water will come out. Isn't it? Or we press an electric switch, light will turn on, there is no certainty. Now that kind of uncertainty is not there usually in America. So now, although there is greater external certainty in the first world countries as compared to the third world countries, curiously, anxiety levels in the first world countries are more than in the third world countries. And not only that, researchers have also found that when people, say Indians or Chinese, they are probably the most maximum number of people who emigrate from the third world to the first world. So they found that people who usually emigrate from these third world countries to first world countries, their material prosperity increases. The external level of certainty increases, but still their anxiety levels shoot up. Anxiety doesn't go down. Now, why is that? If externally there is greater certainty, then we can never have complete certainty at the external level. But still, there's a greater level of certainty, still there is anxiety. So anxiety is caused not just by external uncertainty. Anxiety is also caused by internal instability. Our inner mentality. What happens for many people is that when they move from a materially less prosperous country to a more materially prosperous country, they also may become materially prosperous. But that material prosperity fuels materialism. And when the mentality becomes more materialistic, then no matter how much we have, it is never enough. When the greed becomes fueled, then the mentality internally has become uncertain. Mentality internally has become infected. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, in 16.11 and 12, in 16.12 he states, Chintam aparimeyam cha pralayantam upashitaha kamopabhoga parama etavaditi nishchitaha. So he says, chinta aparimeya. Chinta, anxiety. How much? Prameya is measurement. Aparimeya means immeasurable. Immeasurable anxiety. Till what point? Pralayantam pashrita. Till the moment of death. This afflicts whom? He talks about kamo bhog parama. Those who have decided that the supreme parama, etavaditi nishchita, they are certainly ascertained, they are completely convinced that the goal of life, the standard of successful life is kamo bhog, enjoying material things. So the more we think that enjoying material things is the standard of progress, is the standard of success, is the standard of happiness, then we subject ourselves to anxiety. What is the correlation between the two? Because when we are, multiple correlations can be made. I'll focus on one over here. That when we are infatuated with the idea that externals will make me happy, then that externals that keeps us, no matter how much we have, we feel happiness is out there. Happiness is out there. Sometimes in a computer, we may get a false alarm setting. Something has gone wrong, and say if we have a computer system which is acting like a security for our house, and it gives an alarm signal. And now we may say, "Oh, has somebody come into the house?" And I look in this door, nobody's there. I look at that window, is somebody coming? I look at all the windows, all the doors. I look from all possible ways. Actually, there is nobody who is coming, and still the alarm is ringing. Alarm is ringing. Alarm is ringing. Now, what is happening? That normally the alarm should ring if there is some trespassing that has happened in the house, some authorized, unauthorized entry. But if there is some corruption in the software, and there's a false alarm that is triggered, no matter how many doors we close, no matter how many windows we close, still the alarm keeps ringing. Still the alarm keeps ringing. Sometimes when that happens, we just have to shut down the security system. Otherwise, the alarm keeps ringing. So just like that alarm keeps ringing, no matter, although there is no actual stimulus outside. Similarly, you know, for us, sometimes when the mind gets affected by, when the software of the mind gets affected, then certain alarm-like desires get triggered. And we think, I want this, I want that, I want that. No matter how many things we get, we are never satisfied. Because the problem is not the particular thing. Having or not having that thing. The problem is that actually the setting has gone wrong. Just like alcoholism is an addiction. So there is another form of addiction which is even more pervasive, that is called as shopaholism. Shopaholism means just keep shopping, shopping, shopping. Shop, 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 shop till you drop. So some people who just, you know, go to a shopping mall and they just shop, buy this looks good, maybe I'll use this. And they come back home and then family members ask them, why did you buy this? Okay, I thought it'll be good. Actually, sometimes people have some their warehouses or their cupboards filled with things which they purchased, and after purchasing never use them, just lying there. So what happens? That idea that some people feel that my sense of self-worth, that I am someone, that comes by buying. Now buying is important, shopping is essential for things. But when the mind gets the idea that, what is the shopaholic's mentality? You know, the shopaholic's mentality is your self-worth is determined by how much you shop. So if you shop more, that means you are a bigger person. Shop less, then you are an insignificant person. Now, actually our self-worth is not dependent on how much we shop. Our self-worth is actually determined by who we are and what we are doing in our life. But when the mind setting gets distorted and the software gets corrupted, no matter how much they shop, still they are not satisfied. Just keep shopping, keep shopping. So here, the lobha pravrittirarambha karmanam ashamasvaha. There's an insatiable desire that comes when the mind is corrupted. by greed. So when this has happened, when the software is corrupted by greed, say so mind is corrupted by anything, I'm just giving greed as one example. When it is corrupted, then no matter how much we achieve, it will never be enough. Because the problem is in the software setting. Srila Prabhupada writes in the purport of this 14.12 to 14.16.17, he says that actually when we are dissatisfied in the mode of passion, that dissatisfaction cannot be cured by acquiring things. That dissatisfaction has to be cured only by purification, rising to the mode of goodness. Then only the mode of goodness is characterized by contentment. The mode of passion is characterized by dissatisfaction. So we will, as long as the software is in the mind is in the mode of passion, whatever we have, we will stay dissatisfied. When I was doing my engineering, my dream was always that I wanted to be a topper, wanted to be academic achiever. And I was always among the toppers. But I was never the topper. Number one, distinct, unique number one. Many times I was a joint number one, sometimes I was second, sometimes I was third. So finally I gave GRE in my third year of engineering. And then I loved English since my childhood as a language. So I did fairly well in GRE. I got 2350 out of 2400. And I was first in the whole state of Maharashtra at that time. Not only first in my college, but first in the history of my college. And then I felt elated, you know. I think now I've achieved my dreams. I'm happy. But then I was happy for some time, but afterwards I realized, you know, just looking at the mark sheet doesn't give any happiness. It's only when people come and congratulate then you feel happy. And then a few of my friends didn't congratulate me. So then when I was with them, I was thinking, what is this? Don't you know what I have achieved? Why are you not congratulating me? And when it happened for the third time, it was almost like I had a out-of-body experience. Not exactly out-of-body experience, but I sort of saw myself from outside. It struck me, actually, by becoming a GRE topper, I have not become happier. I have actually become more dependent for happiness on others. In the past, I could just meet with others and start talking things. But now, whenever I meet with someone, I'm expecting they should congratulate me. And if they don't congratulate me, then I feel dissatisfied. Then a few months later, I came to know that some other student from some other university, he had got 2360. And my first thought was, I'm going to give GRE again and I'm going to get 2370. I'm going to get 2370. Then at that time I thought, what am I doing? What am I doing? This is just a dead end. This is just an endless chase. Okay, if I get 2370, somebody might get 2380. Where is the end for this? It is, there's nothing wrong in achieving, nothing wrong in topping. Certainly, if we have talents, we need to use those talents. But the idea that outer achievement will give inner contentment, these two are different things. We have talents, we can and we should work hard and achieve. We should. God has given us talents, we are meant to use those talents. But the idea that achievement will bring contentment, that is a misunderstanding. Contentment is actually a state of mind. It is not a state of our finances. It is not. It can, they are related. But primarily it is a state of the mind. If the mind is not in the mode of goodness, no matter how much we have, we will not be satisfied. So the whole focus of modern society is on improving the externals, on improving the hardware. But while improving the hardware, the software, the mind, very little attention is being paid. And because of that, there is enormous dissatisfaction. Okay. Now, I'll go into a little detail in this topic. So what is the correlation between the brain and the mind? Many people, when they face mental health problems, they face anxiety, they face depression, then they go to psychiatrists and they take some medication. And sometimes they get cured. So how exactly are our feelings? Do they come from the mind? Do they come from the brain? Where do they come from? What exactly is happening? We'll try to understand this. As I explained, the mind is a software. Now, the brain is a part of the body. And the body is the hardware. So in the hardware, we could say the brain is like the CPU. It is the central processing unit. And in the brain, whatever we think, whatever we feel, the physical instrument for doing that is the brain. Just like right now I'm speaking. So the thought is coming from me, the person, the soul. It is channeled through the mind. But when it has to be expressed, the tool for expressing it is the throat, is the organ of speech. So all of you are hearing. And for that, now it is you, the soul, who is hearing. But the tool for hearing is the ear. If somebody puts earplugs around their ears and the earplugs are sound cancelling, noise cancelling, then the soul is there, the sound is coming, but it will not reach the person because the ears are blocked. So for the soul to function in this world, the physical tools which are appropriate are essential. For seeing, the eyes are essential. For speaking, the throat is essential. For hearing, the ears are essential. Similarly, actually, for thinking, feeling and willing, the central coordinating unit, as I said in computers, central processing unit, central coordinating unit for all our bodily actions is the brain. So the brain is vital for any function. And nowadays, there's a tendency in psychiatric circles, not among all psychiatrists, but among many, to try to reduce all our emotions to simply brain chemical flow. That this is called this idea of reductionism. And if you have any problems, then just take some chemicals, take some medicines, and you will become happy. So in fact, there was a brain scientist who proposed that in the future, once we understand more properly how the brain produces emotions, then, you know, we would have a machine, a remote control machine with buttons pressed on it. You could have a happiness button. You could have an excitement button. You could have an energy button. You could have a suspense button. Whatever emotion you want to feel, just press the button. That sort of chemical will be secreted in the brain and you will feel that emotion. Now, this has not happened at all. We are nowhere near that. But still, the brain is connected with emotion. So how does it exactly happen? So now, the heart, the soul, is the source of all emotion. The soul is the source of consciousness. And consciousness is the basis of emotions. Without consciousness, we can't function at all. So if the brain may still not be damaged when a person has died, if the soul is not there, there will be no experience or emotions at all. So soul is essential. Now when we use the word heart, the word heart often we use in a metaphorical sense. Or when somebody says, oh, you broke my heart. You're not talking about a biological heart. It's not that that is broken into pieces. Although we sometimes use the shape of the biological heart to refer to the metaphorical heart. The metaphorical heart is the seat of emotions. The biological heart is simply an organ in the body. So now where is the seat of emotions? actually, that ultimately the soul is the source of consciousness, and consciousness is the basis of emotions. So when we say heart, for all practical purposes, the heart and the soul is the same. So the soul and the heart, they are both actually the reservoir of the source of emotions, the seat of emotions. So when we talk about dealing with mental health issues, there are some scientists who say that actually, you know, you just have to find out what is wrong with the brain and deal with the brain issues, and then all mental health issues will be resolved. But there are several fascinating scientific studies themselves which point that there is something more than the brain to us. So, Dr. Wilder Penfield is considered to be the father of neurosurgery. He's a Nobel laureate neurosurgeon, and he's written this book called The Mystery of the Mind. He studied the human brain for nearly four decades, rigorously. And as a neurosurgeon, sometimes if there is a tumor in the brain, that tumor part has to be removed. And then he tried to find out which part of the brain is removable, and which part, how the brain functions, which part of the brain is related to which function. Now, to some extent, we know that, say, a particular lobe of the brain is connected to the motor nervous system. So he did this experiment that he had a subject. He told the subject, raise your hand. He raised the hand, and then he observed the corresponding part of the brain, say the frontal lobe, whichever it is, that part of the brain got activated. And he asked the subject, what happened? He says, I raised my hand. Okay. Put your hand down. Put his hand down. What happened? I put my hand down. And he found that part of the brain had been deactivated. Then, the brain can also be activated using external electrodes, external probes. So he activated that part of the brain through external stimulus, and the hand went up. And he asked the subject, what happened? He said, my hand went up. Did you raise your hand? Said, no, I didn't. You did. Then he deactivated that part of the brain. The hand went down. What happened? He says, my hand went down. Did you put your hand down? Said, no, I didn't. You did. Now, to understand the implications of this experiment, let's consider a computer and a printer setup. The printer is the part which prints, that is often called as the printing hand. So now say, I have a print button on my computer. When I press the print button, the printing hand starts moving. So the print button is like the lobe of the brain, which when pressed, which when activated, the hand moves up or down. Now, I can press the print button and the printing hand will move. Or you can come to my computer and you can press the print button. And then also the printing hand will move. So now, in the second case, Dr. Penfield pressed the print button, because he activated that part of the brain by which the hand moved up and down. Now the question comes, who activated the brain in the first case? The brain is simply the channel for activation. It is not the source of the activation. In the second case, the source of the activation was Dr. Penfield. Who was the activator in the first case? And to find this out, Dr. Penfield repeated the same experiment while activating different other parts of the brain. And he said, activating different parts of the brain triggered different thoughts, different desires, different emotions, different memories. But no matter whichever part of the brain he activated, no activation of any part of the brain ever gave the subject the feeling that I am the doer, that I am the activator. So the subject was always the observer. Oh, my hand has gone up. I am observing my hand going up, but I am different from it.
So after 4 decades of studying the brain like this, he concluded that the brain is a computer, but it is programmed by something that is outside itself. Something that is outside itself. This means that those neuroscientists who try to reduce everything down to brain phenomena, all our emotions, all our consciousness, all our experiences down to brain phenomena, they are actually mistaken. In the philosophy of science, this is called as the hard problem of consciousness. The hard problem of consciousness means that the brain, no matter how complicated its analysis that we do, no matter how complicated it may be, and no matter how detailed our analysis becomes, see, ultimately, the brain is made up of chemicals, atoms and molecules. And atoms and molecules don't have emotions. They don't feel anything. So where does our consciousness, where do our feelings, where do they come from? That is a mystery. So we are discussing this for the purpose of understanding that hardware problems, so that software problems are distinct from hardware problems. Even with cutting-edge neuroscience, our emotions, the sense of agency, that I, the doer, that is not present in the brain. That is something different from the brain. That agent who does things, who is the activator, that activator is actually using the brain to do things. Now, science cannot tell us in detail what is there beyond the brain. That there is a mind and there is a soul and there are two different things. That is something science cannot tell us, because science focuses on empirical data. And from the empirical perspective, we can't even know whether there is a mind or a soul. But what we can infer is there is something beyond the brain. Something beyond the brain that is the activator. Sometimes we may see a machine that is working automatically. Now, automatic machine simply means that it has been programmed by someone whom we cannot see. There has to be someone, intelligent programmer, who is out there somewhere. So the brain is a program. It's programmed, but it is programmed by something that is outside itself. So now, I talked about how consciousness originates from the brain. At the same time, researchers have found that there are mood-altering chemicals. For example, at a very gross level, if people take alcohol, then their behavior changes. They might just be feeling, thinking and feeling in one way, and after take alcohol, their whole feeling changes. There are psychedelic drugs, which actually they're mood-altering drugs. People take that and they suddenly start feeling very different. So if our emotions, they're originating in our consciousness, then how is it that certain chemicals can change those, taking certain chemicals, how can they change our moods? How can they change our emotions? To understand this, see, there is a source and there is a trigger. The two are different. So if a gun is shot and a bullet shoots out and kills someone, there's a trigger which was pressed because of which the bullet was shot out. But the trigger is not the cause of the wound to the person who was shot. If the trigger was pressed, if there was no bullet in the gun, then nothing would have happened. So trigger is a starting point. Now I'm trying to say that the source of consciousness and the starting point of emotions, the two are not necessarily the same. Yes. The source of consciousness comes from the soul. But specific emotions we experience, they may start with certain points, which may be external also. So for example, now if we see certain food item and we decide, I want to eat that. Now if I'm asleep at that time, I'm unconscious, and the food item, somebody may keep it in front of me, but I'll not feel anything. Because consciousness is not there. So consciousness is the source of all perception, all emotion. But specific emotions may start from certain external points. If consciousness were not there,
then that emotion would not be generated even if the external point is there or not there. So like that, the emotions that we experience, they can start at various points. First is, most of us, they start from external stimulus. We see something and then we like it, we desire it. We see it, we don't like it, we feel aversion for it. So most of the time, the emotions that we experience, they start with some external cause. Sometimes the emotions may also come from simply a mental recollection. It means there's really no stimulus, but suddenly some memory pops up in our head. And then some people just start feeling nostalgic. Oh, I'm in America, I want to be in India, I was at my native place, so many relatives are there, so many friends are there. Oh, there was a lake near which I would go and play in my childhood. Now what has happened? There may be no external stimulus for that kind of thought. It's just a mental recollection that pops up. So Prabhupada gives the example that if there is a pool of water, not a flowing body of water like a river, but like a pond. Now, sometimes a stone is thrown into the pond and because of that ripples are created. But sometimes some fermentation happens deep under the water and because of that suddenly bubbles come. Both ways it can happen. So like that, so the emotions that come up in us, they can come from external stimuli. We see something and then we get attracted to it. We get repelled by it. Whatever it is, the emotion comes up. Or sometimes the emotions may come simply because of some internal recollection that happens. Either way, the point is that there has to be consciousness present for the emotions to be experienced. Beyond this, there's a whole, an entirely different kind of emotion that is spiritual, which we don't experience much right now. That actually comes from the soul and is related to the soul's original nature. It is related to the soul's original relationship with the Supreme Soul, Krishna. So, some of our emotions may be spiritual. Some of our, spiritual in the sense that they are connected with our identity as souls. Some of our emotions, they may be mental in the sense that they originate because of some mental recollection. Some of our emotions may have a physical origin. They may start with some external stimulus. Like this, emotions can start from various points. Now, just as there can be external objects that can trigger emotions. Now, what happens when we actually see a particular object and then the emotion is triggered? Say a person sees an image that triggers sensual desires. What exactly is happening at that time? They're seeing that object, then certain things, the visual data, whatever image they are seeing, that enters through the eyes into the brain. Then the mind starts imagining. And then, say, sensual desire is triggered within the person. When this is happening, the source is the particular image that we are seeing. But that image comes into the brain. And that image comes into the brain. At that time, in the brain, certain chemicals are secreted. And then as the mind starts imagining more and more, those chemicals are secreted more and more. And then that leads to certain bodily stimuli also. Some bodily responses are generated. And then the person may act in the particular. Say if we see a food item. And then what happens? That thought goes into the brain. Through the eyes, through the optic nerve, it goes into the brain. And it goes into the brain. The particular area of the brain which is connected to the food that is activated. And then certain chemicals may be secreted in the brain because of that. And then signals that go from the brain, they go to the tongue. And the tongue, saliva comes. So saliva normally comes, that's a preparation for eating. So this is all simply physical. Now, in the normal case, the external physical object triggers the particular chemicals in the brain which lead to salivation and which lead to maybe the desire to eat, the craving to eat, it becomes physically manifested. The same thing can be done without any external stimulus. The external stimulus secretes certain chemicals in them. But the same thing can be done without any external stimulus in the sense of a sense object. If those chemicals can be secreted in the brain by certain chemicals being inserted, by people taking something. So for example, there are substances called aphrodisiacs. Aphrodisiacs are people which are substances which make people sexually stimulated. So now what is happening? Basically, they are certain substances which when ingested, they make the person, that kind of chemicals are secreted in the brain. And then the people start feeling sexually stimulated by that. So now, in essence, whether the stimulus is coming from an external sense object, which creates certain activation of chemicals in the brain, or it is somebody takes some substance and that creates activation in the brain. That is, the source may be different, but essentially the point is that the brain is involved in it. And because the brain is involved, so certain emotions will be felt at that time. Now conversely by this, let me take this forward to explain this further. Okay. So every action has a physical component. When I'm happy, I laugh. When I laugh, say my facial muscles get shifted in a particular way, which reflects laughter. Just as every action has a physical component, similarly, every emotion that we have, it has a neurological component. But if somebody says, but actually, you know, when you laugh, what is happening? Your face is getting shifted in a particular way. And therefore, that is all that there is to laughter. Sometimes, you know, there are some small children and some relatives want to just play with them. The relative may come and tickle the tummy of the child. The tummy is tickled, the child will start laughing. Now, when the child starts laughing, is that laughter happiness? Is that laughter happiness? If that laughter were happiness and the goal of all of us is to become happy, then we all can have our own, you know, because we tickle ourselves to happiness. Or if we don't want to tickle ourselves, you know, we can manufacture some perpetual tickling machines. And we're perpetually tickling ourselves, we'll be happy. Now, actually, at a physical level, the stimulus of tickling may lead to the response of happiness. Sorry, maybe response may lead to the response of laughter. But there is no happiness over there. A physical response can stimulate a physical response. And a person is very glum, depressed. Yeah, if they're tickled and they laugh, they may feel a little better. But that feeling a little better is actually different from happiness. Real happiness is something different. Real happiness is something which we feel internally, and then that expresses itself as laughter, as a smile. So, tickling a person may lead to the response of laughter, but that is not real happiness. Similarly, putting some chemicals in the brain, taking some pills, may lead to an altering of some emotions. So a person is feeling depressed, take some antidepressant. That may make the person feel a little better. But that is actually simply a chemical response to a chemical stimulus. Just like there is a physical response to a physical stimulus, tickling is a physical stimulus, laughter is a physical response. But that does not necessarily mean the person is happy. Happiness is something much deeper. It's different. Similarly, there can be a chemical stimulus. A person takes an antidepressant pill and that produces a chemical response. The person starts feeling better. The depression starts going away. That's true. It works. But just as a last, you know, just as tickling doesn't lead to lasting happiness of any kind. Although laughter is there, tickling doesn't lead to any lasting happiness. Similarly, antidepressants can't solve any lasting problems. They can help a person feel better temporarily, but they can't solve problems at a lasting level. So nowadays there are people who talk about chemical nirvana. Nirvana is a state of peace, a state of bliss. And they say, just take some chemicals. Ultimately, you know, the state of nirvana is just a state of the brain. So if you find the right chemicals, all of us can achieve nirvana. All of us can achieve samadhi. All of us can become perfect. Now, whatever state of mind we want, we can achieve just by taking chemicals. This doesn't work. The reductionistic approach is to pathologize all human problems. If you feel anxiety, oh, you know, go and take anti-anxiety pill. If you feel depressed, take anti-depression pill. If you feel lonely, take anti-loneliness pill. Now, actually, this doesn't work. And there are researchers also who have written about this. This is James Davis is a psychiatrist, a disillusioned psychiatrist. Has written a book called Cracked, Why Psychiatry is Doing More Harm Than Good. So he's now, I'll talk about psychiatry a little bit more, but say the problem with psychiatry is that it's very difficult to diagnose specifically. If I have malaria, I can take a blood sample and I can find out this is a particular chemical, this is a particular foreign body that has come in my body and because of which this disease has come. So they did an experiment. They had the same person go to 6 different psychiatrists, and he was told you describe a set of six symptoms, and he described those 6 symptoms, and 6 different psychiatrists diagnosed it in 6 different ways, and prescribed 6 different set of medications. Now what happened? It's not that psychiatrists were bad. It's not that psychiatrists were exploitative. It's just that, actually, depending on the way the person spoke, depending on the way the psychiatrist heard, among those 6 symptoms, one psychiatrist emphasized one symptom, another psychiatrist emphasized another symptom. And based on that, they came with very widely varying diagnoses. So in that way, when we all face grief in life, we all face disappointment in life, we all face rejection in life, these are human problems. And this need a human solution. We need to grow as human beings. We need to grow internally. We need to grow spiritually. That's how we deal with these problems. But if you don't do that, if you try to look for chemicals, see every human problem as a chemical problem and see every solution to it as a chemical solution, then we cheat ourselves. And then that leads to chemical dependency. And that leads to side effects, and it can lead to a whole set of problems. Now, this does not mean that that psychiatric medicine should never be taken. That's not the point. The point is that when there is this tendency to, our topic was that the software problems cannot be solved by hardware change. So we cannot deal with the problems at the level of emotions simply by taking some chemicals. Now the other extreme, somebody may go to and say that, you know, if you are practicing spirituality, you should never take any mental medicine. Any medicine, no kind of, you should never know. A person who is chanting Hare Krishna, why do they need to go to a psychiatrist? No, it's not like that. Actually speaking, somebody may have a problem. I know one devotee, he just couldn't sleep. He was so frustrated, he couldn't sleep. The body needed sleep, but he just couldn't sleep. Finally, he went to a doctor, a psychiatrist, and he found that there was a particular chemical deficiency in the brain. Just gave one injection, and for 5 months he had been struggling to sleep. He was easily able to sleep. So it's not that the spiritual is the replacement for the material. The spiritual and the material are complementary. No, it's not that, say, every day, in the morning we wake up, and we chant Hare Krishna attentively, 64 rounds. 64 rounds chanting is not going to remove the bad breath of the mouth.
We have to brush our teeth for that.
Now, chanting, to expect that chanting should remove bad breath, we are underutilizing chanting. Chanting is meant for something much bigger. Chanting is meant to purify our heart. So just as we understand that chanting is not going to remove my bad breath, nor should I expect it to. So there can be mental health problems that have specific origin in certain structural or chemical imbalance in the brain. And if that is the case, then if somebody is required to take mental psychiatric treatment, then that should not be considered as a spiritual deficiency. Because you're not chanting Hare Krishna, that's why you're mentally weak and that's why you have to do this. If somebody needs it, that is fine. But the problem is, we should not think that that is what every human emotion, and to manage my emotions, that is what we all need. Everybody will go through grief, everybody will go through disappointment. And most of us, we need to grow internally to deal with such emotions. Okay. So I hear something got deleted actually. Basically, I said that there is structural and chemical issues specifically they're diagnosed. In a psychiatric diagnosis, okay, this particular chemical is deficient or this particular structural damage is there in the brain. Then therefore you need some psychiatric treatment. If there's a specific diagnosis, at that time, even a devotee may need psychiatric treatment. That is not a character flaw or a devotional deficiency. That is just a biological necessity. So, we don't have to position medication for the mind and devotion as competitors. Just because you are a devotee, you don't need to take this. Or, we have to understand that different minds have different needs. Some of us, by a practice of bhakti itself, we all of us, wherever we are, a practice of bhakti will help us to manage our emotions better. I'll talk more about the practice of bhakti later in our future sessions. But here, the main point is that we as devotees need to have a very balanced attitude. Balanced attitude is, for millions of years, people have dealt with the problems of life without needing psychiatric treatment. So most of us, we won't need psychiatric treatment. Most people don't need it. But there can be authentic mental health problems, in which cases some people need psychiatric treatment. We don't have to make it a judgment. It's not that emotions come from the brain or emotions originate in the brain. The emotions are something much deeper. So occasionally some people may need it. And those who need it, they can take it. But again, when they are taking, so different minds have different needs. Some people may have a body that is more sickly, and a brain that is also more prone to sickness, imbalance. And they may need something like that. If at all such medication is taken, yeah, there's a painkiller and there's an antibiotic. So the painkiller, whatever medication we are taking at the physical level, that is ultimately like a painkiller. If you have to deal with our emotions, somebody is feeling too depressed, and they take an antidepressant pill. That is basically like a painkiller. That antidepressant pill is not going to remove the depression permanently. Actually, the pain, if somebody is in very great pain and they are told, you just take the antibiotic, that will cure you. Well, it will, but what about the pain in between? They may need the painkiller to deal with that. But if they think that, oh, I've taken the painkiller and therefore now I'm feeling good, why do I need to take anything else? Why do I need to take any antibiotic? The painkiller itself is enough. That is foolishness. The painkiller is covering the pain. It is not curing the pain. Similarly, whatever we do at the physical level, whether it is earning more money, whether it is getting a bigger house, whether it is shopping 100 things, whether it is taking psychiatric medicine, all of them fall in the category of improving the hardware. Now, they are all like painkillers. Depending on the particular situation we are in, we may feel a particular kind of pain, which others may not feel. So we don't have to go on a campaign for a painkiller or a campaign against a painkiller. Our point is, take the medicine, take the essential medicine, take the curative medicine. So when we take the curative medicine, that is what is going to cure us. The curative medicine is the process of bhakti. The process of bhakti purifies us. Purifies us means that it weakens our unhealthy emotions. It strengthens our healthy emotions.
And thus we move towards contentment internally. This process of purification we'll be discussing elaborately in a later session. But at this point, in general, any attempt at material progress, that is to be understood like a painkiller. It may be necessary for some people based on the pain that they are going through, but if that's what needed for some, they can take it. But to think that that is the solution, the painkiller is going to solve the problem, that is a mistake. As devotees, when we focus on the process of bhakti yoga, that is like the curative medicine which will ultimately purge us of all the unhealthy emotions. And a devotee will become spiritually satisfied. Brahma Bhuta Prasannatma. In 18.54, Krishna says that the devotee situated at the spiritual level is prasanna, is joyful. Because joyfulness is the nature of the soul. And when we become purified of unhealthy emotions, that natural joyfulness of the soul becomes manifested. I'll summarize. I spoke today on the continuing the second part of what your phone can teach you about the mind. I spoke about improving the hardware can't deal with software problems. If because of a software issue, there is nothing coming on my phone screen, just changing the screen again and again is not going to get something on the screen. I have to deal with the underlying software issue. Like that, people today have progressed enormously materially as compared to the recent past. And the technological wizardry, the comfort levels that we have are much more. And yet, there is so much anxiety. People are comfortable, but they are comfortably miserable. So normally we think anxiety is caused by external uncertainty. Although there is external certainty, relatively speaking, in the first world, still there is anxiety levels which are shot up. Why? Because there is internal insecurity. There is internal instability that is caused by a materialistic worldview. Materialistic worldview, especially the mode of passion, that means in the mode of passion, the default setting of the mind is to be dissatisfied. So the mind may say, because you don't have this, so you're dissatisfied. Get this. But even after we get it, because the default setting is dissatisfaction, the mind will find some other reason to be dissatisfied. And we get that, still it will find another reason to be dissatisfied. Like people become shopaholics. They think that by shopping I feel good. But no matter how much they shop, still that craving remains. Like say, a security system where there is a fault in the setting. So even where there is no threat, still the alarm is ringing. So like that, the dissatisfaction is coming. Although there is actually no reason to be dissatisfied. We have what it needs to be satisfied in life. So at that time, the cure has to be, the problem in software, corruption in software, the cure has to be at the software level, not at the hardware level. And that ultimate cure at the software level is the process of purification that comes through the practice of bhakti. But then, we discussed that sometimes people who have mental health problems, they take psychiatric medicine and they become better. They feel better. Or there are mood altering chemicals. How do these have an effect? So then in that connection I discussed how the brain is a part of, is like the CPU in the hardware. And whatever we do, the brain, there will be a neurological component to it. It's like every action has a physical component. So every emotion has a neurological component. But we discussed Dr. Penfield's experiment, which shows that the brain is like a computer, but the source, it is programmed by something outside of itself. The source of consciousness is extracerebral, is outside the brain. And so, normally speaking, there is just as tickling is a physical stimulus, which will lead to a physical response of laughter. But that is not really happiness. Similarly, a certain chemical stimulus, say that stimulus that makes trigger sensual desire, stimulus that triggers some sort of pleasure, that when it is given in the brain through some pills, through some chemicals, through some drugs, whatever, then that may stimulate a particular response. But that is not really that emotion. That is simply a chemical response to a chemical stimulus. The actual experience is something much deeper.
And just said the laughter from tickling doesn't really lead to happiness. It doesn't last for long. Similarly, the effect of, say, antidepressant doesn't last for long. So, then we discussed that. Is it that... So, to think that human problems can be solved by chemical means is an illusion. And such things only lead to chemical dependency, and it leads to side effects. All kinds of complications can occur. And such psychiatric treatment can make things worse rather than better. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that all medical treatment, psychiatric treatment can be replaced simply by the spiritual. The spiritual and the material are complements. So I had to chant Hare Krishna, but to remove bad breath, I had to brush my teeth also. So in some specific cases, when there is structural damage or there is specific chemical deficiency in the brain, at that time, certain people may need some psychiatric treatment. But the psychiatric treatment should not be seen as a panacea, as a solution to our problems. So we don't see the spiritual and the medical as competitors. We see them as complements where necessary. So any material form of improvement, whether it is earning more money, getting more material facilities, or taking some psychiatric treatment, that is ultimately like a painkiller for removing the bad feelings that are there inside us, for tackling those feelings. Temporarily they will go away, but they will come again. The real treatment is the practice of bhakti, which should purify us, removing the unhealthy feelings and strengthening the healthy feelings within us. So we don't have to campaign for or against the painkiller, but to focus on the medicine. So most people don't need psychiatric treatment, but if somebody needs it, that is not to be treated as a character deficiency or as a devotional deficiency. You see, simply that is a biological necessity for some people. And focus on the painkiller ultimately is not going to cure, it only covers. Some people may need it, but the important thing is we all need to take the essential medicine, the curative medicine of bhakti. By this curative medicine, no matter what the state of agitation of our mind is, that all can be removed. We all can experience through purification, we can move towards pacification and ultimately sublime satisfaction. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Are there any questions or comments? Can you repeat? Temporary things go back?
So, when I start taking shelter of some temporary things, then the tendency is again and again to go back and justify. So, how to strengthen the indulgence so that I can focus on the actual solution.
So, whenever we get relief in something temporary, the tendency is to again go and take shelter of that again and again.
Yeah, just like you mentioned that taking medicine or...
I understood. So, see, the temporary shelter can be a means to go towards the eternal shelter. Or, the temporary shelter can become the replacement to the eternal shelter. Now, which will happen will depend on our own intelligence. If our intelligence is not spiritually guided, if we are not studying Shastra regularly, if we are not spiritually training our intelligence, then we will just simply be satisfied with material solutions. Actually, the material solutions are not solving our problems. We'll think, yes, not now, but in future they will solve. Or anyway, later I'll talk about spirituality later. let me just be satisfied with this and go on with my life.
So, in general,
the fundamental difference between our material needs and the spiritual needs is that the material needs are specifically felt as specific material needs. That means, when I'm hungry, I feel hunger which prompts me towards food. When I feel thirst, I feel a particular sensation in my body which prompts me towards water. However, when there is a spiritual need, often the mind tricks us and it misdiagnoses it. So many times when there is some existential dissatisfaction, when I'm dissatisfied or frustrated with something deeper in my life, I try for some easier palliative. Many times people overeat not just because their, say, tongue is uncontrolled. That could be one thing. But people overeat because something is eating them internally. They're worried about something and food becomes the immediate source of comfort. So, when food is taken not as a biological need, but it is taken out of a need for a psychological shelter, then we eat more than what is healthy for the body. So, we all need material things for living in this world. Although they are temporary, we need them. Food can't solve our problems, but we need food. We need house, we need money. But the problem is, if we are not perceptive enough, if not careful enough, we will think that the material solution itself will give us a lasting solution. And in the pursuit of that, we will actually aggravate the problem. So food is needed. But if I take food not for biological sustenance, I take food for psychological shelter, I'll keep eating more and more and more and more. And eventually I'll eat so much that I can't eat anymore. And then I won't get that psychological shelter, that discomfort that is there, that anxiety that is there, whatever is eating me up, that is still going to eat me up. But now, I have overeaten, I have spoiled my health, I have added to my fat, I have created another set of problems. So to understand that, we need our intelligence. So it is only through the intelligence that we can recognize the need for spirituality. See, the physical needs, we don't need much intelligence to recognize them. When I am feeling cold, that I need a sweater. I don't need to study Bhagavad Gita to understand that. It's simply a biological need which immediately we recognize it. But when we don't have spiritual knowledge, then that which is a spiritual need, we misdiagnose it to be some material need. And which material need we'll misdiagnose it to be, that will depend on our specific conditionings. That will depend on whatever it is that we may have taken shelter of. If some person is alcoholic, they may think there is no problem that can't be solved by drinking alcohol. Just drink and forget, all your problems go away. And the problems don't go away, they're still there and they're going to come back in bigger forms. But that's how they have got that conditioning, because of which they think this is the way to solve the problem. So it can be alcoholism, it can be overeating, it can be over-earning. Now, money is essential for security, but some people just make money their sole sense of security. I need to have more money, more money, more money, more money. But ultimately, money cannot comfort us. If I'm distressed, money cannot speak sympathetic words to me. Money cannot speak encouraging words to me. Money cannot help me in the ultimate matters of the heart. And money cannot, itself can't help us to grow spiritually. So material things are essential for functioning in the world. But when we think that they will give us lasting shelter, then when we take them as functional needs, they are valuable, they are essential. But when we take them as replacements for our spiritual needs, then they themselves aggravate us.
Prahlad Maharaj says in the Bhagavatam that Dukh aushadham tadapi dukkham atadhyaham.
Says that which I think is the medicine,
that actually becomes a bigger distress. That becomes a bigger problem. And therefore he says, Yasmat priya priya viyoga sanyoga janma shokagnina sakala yonishudaya manaha dukkhaushadam tadapi dukkhamatadhyaham. So he says, my dear Lord, thinking I like this, I don't like this, I don't want this, I want this. Like this thinking, I've been craving and slaving for so many things. But ultimately when I get those things also, they think they bring their own distress. Therefore, my dear Lord, I just don't want to anymore chase after things according to what my mind says. He says, Vadame Bhavadasya Yogam. My dear Lord, please engage me in your service. Please instruct me how I can serve you. That is what he's praying for, the intelligence. So the intelligence to serve Krishna is the way to getting lasting shelter. And by studying Shastra, that intelligence becomes strong. And then we recognize the role of temporary shelters, but we don't let the temporary shelters replace our quest for the eternal shelter. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Hare Krishna. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
So you mentioned about physical needs and spiritual needs. They are complementary.
Yeah.
But in some cases, like physical needs go down.
Okay. Yeah, so in some cases, like the great acharyas, the physical needs go down. I said, Sri Raghunatha Goswami would eat once in 3 days a little bit curd or something like that. So is it that our physical needs also should go down as we spiritually advance? See, there are exceptions. And the exceptions demonstrate something exceptional. The exceptions don't replace the standard. We have Raghunatha Goswami, who would eat very little. But then we also have Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his associates. They would cook and they would have elaborate feasts. And that is also celebrated as an integral part of bhakti. So it is that at different great souls are used by the Lord to demonstrate different spiritual principles. So Raghunatha Goswami is used by Lord Chaitanya to demonstrate the principle of renunciation at an extraordinary high level. But that does not mean that everybody has to be renounced at that level. No. There was Advaita Acharya, there was many other saints who were actually as spiritually advanced as Raghunatha Goswami. Maybe more or so, we don't know. But still, they were not practicing that kind of renunciation. So the point is, that there are always exceptions which demonstrate an exceptional principle. And we can take inspiration from that. But the exception doesn't replace the rule. The rule is yuktahara viharasya. As Krishna says, one who eats too much or eats too little. One who sleeps too much or sleeps too little. That person cannot become a yogi. Natya ashutastu yogosthi na chaikanta manashtita. Na chati sutna shilasya jagrato nevacharjuna. In 6.16, 17, 18, Krishna talks about this quite elaborately. So for us, see, the important thing is that we don't let anything become a distractor from Krishna. So it was not that Raghunatha Goswami was thinking, you know, I want future generations to remember how renounced I was and therefore I will take only this much. This much. Once in 3 days I will eat something. It is not like that. He was so busy absorbing Krishna that he didn't think about food. On the other hand, you know, we fast Nirjal once and we want everyone to know I fasted Nirjal, you know. So even when you're fasting Nirjal, we are not thinking about Krishna, we are thinking about how many people will praise me for fasting and fasted Nirjal. So we're not really thinking about Krishna at that time. So the important thing is that in general, the material, if we go to either extreme, if I eat too much, if I become too attached to food, and I'm constantly thinking about food, then food can become a competitor to Krishna. Instead of thinking about Krishna, I'm always thinking about food. But at the other side also, if I don't take food at all,
Now, if I decide I want to fast Nirjal, I'm chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, chapati, dal, rice, Hare Krishna, chapati, dal, rice, Hare Krishna. I'm thinking about chanting Hare Krishna, but I'm thinking about food. Well, if that is happening, better take some food and come back and chant Hare Krishna with more focus. See it? So if we go to either extremes, then what happens? Either too much or too little. Then our consciousness gets consumed by that thing. And attached. That's why raga dvesha vimuktaistu. We want our emotions to be available to be invested in Krishna. If there is material attachment, then our emotions get invested in that. If there is material deprivation, then again our emotions get invested in that. Oh, I'm not getting this, I'm not getting this, I'm not getting this. Where it's a fundamental biological need. So the point is that we should learn to position our material life in such a way that it helps us focus on Krishna. And we move forward. So now, this is different people may need to eat different amounts of food. So most of us know that the Pandavas, when they were in the forest, whatever, they were living like Brahmanas. So they would get food in charity. Now, whatever food they would get, Kunti or Draupadi, whoever was there, she would divide that food into two. One half would go to Bhima. And the other half would be divided into five parts. The four Pandavas and Kunti or Draupadi, whoever was in them. Mom is, hey, you are eating so much. Now, it's interesting that that Bhima who eats so much, there's a name for him for that. Now, he's not called a glutton. He's called Vrukodara. One word, a wolf-like belly. Now, that was just his appetite. And he would work that much also. And sometimes Pandavas would get tired. Then actually, Bhima would carry all the Pandavas and Kunti with him. He just run through the forest. He had so much energy. So what happened? That was what he was eating. The important thing is, that it was not that he was eating so much and going to sleep. He was eating and serving. So, different people will have different levels of requirement for sleeping. The important thing is that we are in a consciousness, in a state of consciousness where we can focus on serving Krishna constantly. So we can strive to decrease our biological needs, but the decrease should be organic. It should be natural. It's not that we focus too much of our energy in decreasing our eating. Our focus should be on serving Krishna. And as we keep serving Krishna, we get a higher satisfaction in serving Krishna. Then the biological side will automatically decrease. Does that answer your question? Thank you very much. Shri Prabhupada ki. Gaura Bhakta Vrinda ki. Gaura Prema.